effort to uphold international law when it comes to Israel, that, you know, Washington specifically, but also Canada and some other NATO countries, that they target those who are slowly trying to hold Israeli officials accountable for what are, of course, vast crimes.
And Daniel, this is obviously nothing new. This is not something that's just restricted to this term. Donald Trump, we know back in his first term, he also went after another IEC team, canceling their visas. If you remember the time, that was, I believe, Fatou bin Suda's team. He canceled their visas. He told her he's going to sanction her and target her personally for going after U.S. war crimes and probing them in Afghanistan and in Iraq in his first term. Now, her name was Fatou bin Suda. And the funny thing is that at the time, Mossad director Yossi Cohen also was personally involved in a plot to threaten and pressure Fatou bin Suda to drop a Palestine investigation of war crimes back in Trump's first term, obviously committed by the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine. This is a systemic. This is basically the, what do you guys call it, the modus operandi for these two entities here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's just outrageous because when the West wants to wage war, they like to weaponize human rights to do that, right? And weaponize the ICC to do that. They like to use the International Criminal Court against other countries, right? Other world leaders like Vladimir Putin, for example. Mostly against African leaders, right? It used to, in fact, some people joked it was the African Criminal Court. But they don't want it applied. They don't want the ICC's rules or its gaze to be applied to Western leaders, right? It's good enough for others, but not for the West. Even though, of course, Bill Clinton's administration played a key role in helping draft the Rome Statute of the ICC, and then, of course, refused to have it ratified. All these things just show the pretextual nature of human rights when it comes to the West, right? They use it totally opportunistically.
And that abuse as using it totally opportunistically, Eves, I want to put that to you. What does this do? The selective adjudication of international law and its application, who has to answer for war crimes and who doesn't? What does this do for the rule of law?
Well, there is no rule of law in international affairs, unfortunately, and the basics of international law are just violated. This isn't new. Of course, the U.S. has done this all the time, and its allies. You know, look at the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, obviously the invasion of Iraq in 2003, crass violations of international law. So this isn't new, but what we've seen in the past 21 months is a rapid escalation on that front. And I think to the point that Dan's making about human rights just being completely politicized. I mean, it's just totally it's so crass how Canada's Parliament will pass a unanimous resolution about supposed genocide in Ukraine, genocide against Uyghurs in China, and then enable the real genocide taking place in Gaza, and everything just continues on as if this government is designed, this country is trying to uphold human rights around the world. It's just the crass double standards are so flagrant. I think more and more people are seeing those double standards around human rights talk. But if you pay attention to the dominant media in Canada, the U.S., it's only around the edges where the politicization of all this is discussed. It's throwing away the little bits of international law that that sort of were operational, and it's just might makes right. There's nothing. Israel's made it absolutely crystal clear that there's one policy. It's might makes right, and so long as they have the backing of the mightiest in the world, which we obviously see with these recent sanctions, they have. So long as they have that backing, they're just going to keep killing and killing and killing, and there's little that's going to be done.
And Daniel, I'll also get your take on that. The impact of having the U.S. so blatantly try to erase the war crimes committed by Israeli leadership, try to prevent and even target individuals and organizations from administering or even trying to open the conversation to address war crimes being committed against a civilian population of over 2 million people. This cannot be good precedent, Daniel.
No, I mean, this is a frontal assault on about 150 years of well-settled international humanitarian law, right? The U.S. and Israel have been engaged in a systematic destruction of international humanitarian law, of the war, the law of war, since October 7th of 2023. Essentially, they are going out of their way on a daily basis to show that there are no limits, there are no moral or legal limits that they will recognize in terms of their behavior in prosecuting a war, right? And now we even see aid workers, so-called aid workers who are supposed to be distributing food, shooting Palestinians for sport, both Israeli and U.S. aid workers. It is absolutely disgusting. You know, I think it today is the anniversary, if I'm not mistaken, of the Soweto uprising in South Africa, in which about, I think it's 67 people were killed. And this really became a very important event, which really coalesced the world's opposition to apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israel's murdering over almost 100 people on average per day, after day. So you have at least a Soweto uprising type massacre.
Twice a day.
Every day.
Or multiple times a day.
And gentlemen, and the world is doing nothing. Yeah.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Thank you. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to the both of you. Mr. Eves Engler there joining us from Montreal, Canada, and Daniel Kovalik joining us out of Pittsburgh in the U.S. This brings us to conclude this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Greetings, dear listeners. I'm delighted to welcome you to another hour of thoughtful programming here on Iran Radio. Thank you for being with us. We are honored to have your company. Coming up first is Midstream. Next, we bring you Leaders' Speech, a segment featuring English translations of selected addresses by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Delivered on key occasions, these speeches offer profound spiritual insight, socio-political clarity, and timely guidance on the challenges of our time. After that, we return to radio productions. Up next, Midstream. Stay with us. There is much to discover.
Midstream.
What if I told you that June 13 wasn't just a date?
a gamble by the United States of America and Zionist Israel to bring Iran to its knees, and they failed. The plan? Cripple Iran's leadership, spark chaos through sleeper cells, and knock out air defenses using drone strikes launched from within, all while pretending to negotiate. It was a textbook deception until the Islamic Republic of Iran rewrote the playbook. Instead of falling into disarray, Iran absorbed the blow and flipped the battlefield. Not with fighter jets, but with precision missiles, each one shaking Zionist Israel's sense of control and forcing Washington to shift gears from threats to truce talks. And here's the twist. When Zionist Israel stops a war, it's not out of goodwill. It's because it's hurting deeply. Reports from inside Zionist Israel revealed the cracks. Thousands fled their homes. Compensation claims flooded in. Airlines were jammed with desperate exit requests. Business website called The Globes reported that every Iranian missile triggered around 4,000 compensation claims, and the war forced more than 18,000 Israeli colonial settlers to relocate to hotels and rental homes. And when Reuters says Al Al Airlines received 25,000 flight requests during the war, this is only a small part of the story. But Zionist Israel's real fear? The long game. They know mass departures have happened before and after both intifadas. And now they're terrified the Al-Aqsa flood will trigger another historic exodus. Why did Iran prevail? Geography and strategy. While Zionist Israel relied on air power, Iran invested in missiles. Why? Because reaching the enemy from 2,000 kilometers away without flying over U.S. bases is no small feat. But Iran didn't just reach it. It hit vital fuel and energy infrastructure, sparking fears of a full-blown energy crisis. And while Zionist Israel has tech hubs like the Weizmann Institute, Iran distributed its intellectual power, making it nearly untouchable. Even Russia and China took note. If Iran had fell, God forbid, they were next. That's why what happened in this war may just redraw the global map. This wasn't just a war, it was a message, and the world heard it loud and clear. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. June 13 was supposed to be the day Iran collapsed under a coordinated U.S.-Israeli entity strike. But not only did Iran absorb the hit, it turned the tables and rewrote the rules of engagement. This wasn't just survival. It was a show of strength that deterred Zionist Israel and forced Washington to rethink everything. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ali Hamiyeh, expert in military strategy. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Hamiyeh. Now, how do you think that Iran's strategic use of missile power and not air power redefined the concept of military deterrence in this particular war? And what does it really reveal about the failure of the Western military dogma that we are used to?
Thanks for having me with you today. Let's say, first of all, it's a big comparison between a new technology between the missile power, ground-to-ground power, and air-to-ground power or air force. And this is what represents the Western and Eastern power in the world, divided into, let's see, Russia, Iran, China. They have the most super missile power in the world. And United States, NATO, Israeli entity, AUKUS, JCOS, they have the air superiority. But now what we have seen that, first of all, and according to what they declared, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, they said we underestimate, as quote, they underestimated the Iranian power. Let's say why. First of all, the maneuverability and the flexibility of the missiles to be fired, launched from Iran to the Israeli entity, it took about 7 minutes, and one of them took about 4 minutes. I'm talking about Khurram Shahr 4, which is with the new technology that exhausted, make the Iron Dome and Megan Dome drain, exhausted, and fatigue. With the with the speed of 20,000 kilometers per hour or 16 Mach, and also in a technology called MIRV, which is like a multi-warhead, guided warheads that can attack and destruct the Iron Dome and the Megan Dome in the space, in the also at the ground, with the most superiority of the speed and fire and guided, or fire and control and fire and forget, three kind of missiles. We are talking also about the not only the long range. We are talking about the IRBM. We are talking about also, as they said, that Iranian have the Mark 5 missiles from the fifth generation, which did not used at all. We are talking about also the which is called ICBM. So the most dangerous, most important that Iran fired at the and overwhelmed the Iron and Megan domes in the region. I'm talking about the American bases and also the land of occupied territory. We are talking about the MIRV technology in the Khorramshahr for Mark IV missile.
Well, Dr. Hamid, what is the actual collapse of the U.S.-Israeli entity shock moment that they are very good at? We've seen it before in Syria and Lebanon, even in Palestine. But what does that collapse reveal about the miscalculation in their understanding of Iranian first internal Iranian resilience and also the external posture of Iran? Why didn't this shock moment work against the Islamic Republic?
Let's say, first of all, or second of all, let's say that when they fired the first aggression, when they launched the first aggression against the Islamic State of Iran, they thought that they demolish and they have their victorious day in their hand. But after the retaliation of the Iranian later on at the same night, all their doctrine collapsed. And we see whatever they used as the most powerful air power they have. We are talking about B-2, F-22, cruise missiles, GBU-57, MOP, GBU-43, MOAB. They used it all. And this is the most top-of-the-notch technology of the United States and the Israelis, and could not penetrate the powerful, let's say, the powerful Iran retaliation. Mm-hmm. So I think what's going on is not most powerful missiles of Iran used, but the most powerful and top-of-the-notch technology of United States and the Israelis were used and did not overwhelm or declare any victory against.
So you mean that the West obviously put all its cards on the table while Iran still has a lot of surprises there?
Exactly, exactly. And they, you know, as I said at the beginning that Donald Trump said, we underestimate if we didn't know that Iran is so powerful. So he's admitting that they lost the war and they cannot continue such war against Iran, and especially after the last missile launched at Beersheba, and it was very precise, zero error, and it was pinpoint direct hit at the Israeli post of Microsoft and also military base. So what's going on now in comparison, we see that the Iranian now are on standing on a hard and solid ground. Israelis are melting, and I'm not sentimental now. I'm talking facts. The Israelis are melting. The Israelis jump into the unknown with maybe they had some achievement tactically, but strategically they are going into the unknown.
Well, Doctor, how did the geography, both the physical one and the demographic one, serve here as a weapon for the Islamic Republic of Iran and maybe a weakness for Zionist Israel in this confrontation inside of Iran?
Well, let's see from one point to another point in Iran, maybe from Fordo, an example, to Natanz, you have several hundred kilometers. But between Navatim and Daimona, you have 10 kilometers. So demography and geography, it's on the side of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Iran could absorb and still can absorb big hits from the American and the whole Western Hemisphere against Iran and also from Israel, and still can absorb and retaliate. Imagine if Iran attacked Israel with 200 fighter jets into the whole area of the occupied territory.
I think 10 would be enough.
Exactly, exactly.
Would
Israel will be demolished. Israel will be gone. So that's why Iranian has the upper hand in demography and in geography in a way of strategic behavior. And I think that the Iranian can still absorb and they can retaliate in case of any new aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think it will be disaster for Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ali Hami, expert in military strategy, for telling us what really happened on the ground, because a lot of Western mainstream media is hiding these facts from the Western public and the Western viewers. So thank you for your time and your contribution. Ladies and just stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about hunger has become a weapon in Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In Gaza, the line between life and death has been reduced to a line for food. What was once called humanitarian aid has become a trap where hunger is weaponized and survival is met with live fire. Backed by U.S. funding and Israeli entity force, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has turned aid distribution into a killing field, prompting growing international accusations of genocide. More details in the following report.
In Gaza today, hunger is not just a crisis, it's a death sentence. As starvation tightens its grip on the besieged enclave, more than 700 Palestinians have been killed, not by bombs, but while desperately seeking food. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 743 people have died and nearly 5,000 have been wounded at so-called humanitarian aid distribution sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a project backed by the United States and Zionist Israel. These are not combat zones. These are food lines. The people here, many of them children, are dying for a piece of bread. Mothers are skipping meals. Families are starving. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began operations in late May, but instead of relief, it has become a theater of horror. The controversial foundation, backed with U.S. funding and guarded by American contractors, stands accused not only of overseeing lethal force, but of providing a green light for direct killing. American guards have reportedly opened live fire and thrown stun grenades into unarmed crowds waiting for food. Witnesses and aid workers have reported repeated incidents of live fire, stun grenades, and tank shelling near these food points. A recent Associated Press investigation confirmed that American contractors witnessed live ammunition being used against civilians. Now, damning revelations from inside Zionist Israel itself. Haaretz reports that Zionist Israeli soldiers were not acting rogue, but actually following orders. Orders to shoot at unarmed civilians waiting for food. One soldier described it plainly. It's a killing field. Between 1 and 5 people were killed every day where we were stationed. The Israeli occupation says it has launched an investigation into possible war crimes. But for many in Gaza, justice delayed is justice denied. The evidence is mounting. This is not just a humanitarian crisis, it is a genocide. The U.S., the principal weapons supplier, has funneled tens of billions in bombs, jets, artillery shells, and targeting intelligence, despite clear warnings that these arms are being used in grave violations of international law. Critics, including UN Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, say this militarized aid scheme is deepening the genocide. The U.S. is no bystander. It is an enabler. This is no longer just a humanitarian crisis. It is a war on survival, a war where food is bait and hunger ends in bloodshed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, political writer and analyst and journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thanks a million for being with us. Mr. Hamza, now, given the mounting death toll and eyewitness accounts, how would you characterize the role of this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in what many are now calling a deliberate policy of starvation and of massacre? And how does this really fit into the broader Israeli entity strategy inside of Gaza?
Greetings to you. What is known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is, in fact, one of the tools being employed by the Zionist occupying entity in its confrontation with our people in Gaza. First and foremost, this so-called foundation plays several roles, the most important of which is laying the groundwork for what is intended to become a new governing authority in the post-ceasefire phase in the Gaza Strip. So today, regardless of the specific actions being carried out by this organization, and despite the tragic scenes we witness daily in the media of hundreds martyred while waiting for aid, and the roles played by its members, whether American contractors or so-called Palestinians, its function is fundamentally political. We've seen similar patterns before, including in Lebanon and other regions during wartime, where such organizations were established and led by locals, whether Lebanese in our case or Gazans in the Palestinian context, with agendas far exceeding the distribution of humanitarian aid. In Lebanon, for example, some of those individuals later became prime ministers, party leaders, and key players in national political life, both in Lebanon and abroad. The model in the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is designed to be replicated in the Strip, as Zionist Israel has openly stated in its intentions. Its alternative actors to take over governance in Gaza. This humanitarian gateway, so to speak, is being used by both Zionist Israel and the United States under the assumption that the besieged and bombarded Palestinian citizen will be easily deceived, that they will view any entity offering aid as a savior and, in turn, grant it loyalty or legitimacy.
There's something very interesting going on, Mr. Hamza, with the reports that even Zionist Israel saying, with Haaretz reporting about it, that occupation soldiers were actually ordered by their government to shoot unarmed civilians, and that American contractors, and we heard the videos, they also fired on aid seekers. How do you assess the U.S. full complicity in this, not just in terms of supplying arms to Zionist Israel, but direct operational conduct of this day-to-day war?
Exactly. This clearly proves that the United States is an essential and inherent part of this confrontation. Even before the issue of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, there was the matter of the floating pier in Gaza and the active American push for a direct U.S. presence on the ground in the Strip. Since that moment, the American side has become a key party to this war and to the various schemes the Zionists are attempting to implement in Gaza. Among them, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and the direct involvement of American contractors, as well as certain international organizations. Some of these organizations have issued detailed reports stating they will submit their findings to the UN Security Council, shedding light on the roles of these actors in opening fire, the types of munitions and weaponry used against civilians, and describing the entire operation as a deliberate trap designed to kill civilians through means other than traditional warfare, beyond the already brutal practices of the Zionist occupying forces, such as bombing infrastructure, committing massacres, and burning down tent camps. This foundation has now effectively become a deadly trap, executed by the Americans within their specialized sphere of this war. The U.S. entered Gaza under the guise of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, presenting their presence as a humanitarian initiative to provide aid to the people of Gaza. a move that was politically negotiated and framed as an act of compassion and assistance.
But if that were the case, we wouldn't have seen at the Rafah border, especially inside of Egypt, miles and miles of food trucks that were never allowed in. If this was only a humanitarian conduct for the United States of America, they would allowed those trucks to come in. So there is something political out of this organization.
Naturally, there is now a concerted effort to organize a core group from within Gaza, whether individuals, institutions, or entities, that can serve as the starting point for building a substitute governing body in the Strip. It begins with handing over the most urgent and sensitive responsibility, the distribution of aid. But it doesn't stop there. The scope of responsibilities assigned to this foundation is gradually expanding. Hence, the American presence on the ground in Gaza is not only deeply rooted in intelligence gathering. It is also playing a central role in shaping the political, economic, and social nucleus of the order they intend to install in Gaza after the war, in a phase they themselves refer to as the post-Hamas era.
But I mean, I completely understand that view, but I need to explain something to the viewers here, that we are nearing a two-year duration of genocide against the Palestinian people, who now have fully not only stood by the resistance, but they fully put their fate in the hands of the resistance, which up until last night, they were still conducting operations against the Zionist entity. So how smart it is not to read the room before claiming that they have won politically, that they, that the people will actually allow a new political force to emerge.
Just yesterday, confirming everything we've been discussing, some of those involved in distributing so-called humanitarian aid, individuals from within Gaza, publicly declared their core political agenda to eliminate the Hamas movement. They literally said, "We will continue to liberate the people of Gaza from Hamas." That was the exact term they used. This is a clear and undeniable revelation of the true intentions behind these efforts, a full exposure of the agenda we've been warning about. However, the decisive factor in all of this remains the stance of the people of Gaza themselves. As you rightly pointed out, 2 years into this brutal aggression, the resistance is still standing strong, actively carrying out operations. As you rightly pointed out, 2 years into this brutal aggression, the resistance is still standing strong, actively carrying out operations. And the Palestinian people, after enduring 2 years of relentless bombardment, siege, and deprivation, have not staged a single protest or public demonstration against the resistance, despite the immense suffering and sacrifices they've borne. This reality speaks volumes. The Palestinian people cannot and must not be cornered into a false choice between dying of starvation and thirst under massacres, or submitting to the rule of a blatantly collaborator regime that offers them food and water in exchange for their dignity and their cause.
Added to that, that a lot of the wheat bags, they found to have been including certain medical drugs inside of them that were supposed to be given also to the people. That also speaks a lot. It actually speaks volume about how the United States of America operates. But we have now United Nations experts, Mr. Hamza, and human rights advocates that have increasingly framed what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. There's no way to hide this anymore, based on facts, testimonies, and military patterns inside of Gaza. How do you argue the case of genocide to the Western public? Because here in West Asia, we understand that. We see that. We live it. We have paid blood for it. And what should the global legal and political response be, especially at this moment in time when a lot of calls have been emerging about a possible near an end to what's going on in Gaza?
There is absolutely no room for debate over whether what has been happening and continues to happen in the Gaza Strip constitutes genocide. According to the 1948 Genocide Convention, the definition is crystal clear. Any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, religious group. When we compare this legal definition to the reality on the ground in Gaza, all the core components that allow us to identify genocide are present. First, the intent. From the very beginning of this war, Zionist officials in Netanyahu's government have openly and explicitly expressed their aim to annihilate Gaza and eliminate its population. This declared intent, including statements made by Netanyahu himself, is a matter of public record. Second, the deliberate patterns of aggression carried out by the Israeli occupation forces. Bombing of civilian infrastructure, repeated strikes on schools, the incineration of tents while their occupants sleep inside, destruction of places of worship. All of these are systematic, repeated tactics. These are not military operations in the conventional sense of warfare between armies or armed groups. These are direct, targeted attacks on civilians. This reveals a clear and deliberate strategy aimed at the systematic destruction of Gaza. Additionally, the repeated forced displacement of Palestinian civilians from the north to the center, then to the south of the strip, multiple times within a single month, further confirms this genocidal intent. These displacements coincide with repeated statements from Netanyahu regarding plans to permanently expel Gaza's population, and with Donald Trump's previously declared intention to turn Gaza into a tourist resort, a so-called Gaza Riviera. The intent is clear. The actions are consistent. Together, they leave no doubt. What we are witnessing in Gaza is a full-fledged genocide by every legal, moral, and human standard.
Definitely. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, political writer and analyst, also journalist at the Lebanese Daily Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a commemoration ceremony marking the 36th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise. The ceremony was held in Imam Khomeini's mausoleum on June 4th, 2025.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Based on a definite divine decree, the Zionist regime is collapsing. June 4th, 2025. Now, in the nuclear industry, there is one point that is a key element, and that is uranium enrichment. Our enemies have focused all their attention on this very process of uranium enrichment. They have concentrated their efforts on this. The nuclear industry of such immensity is useless without having the capability for enrichment, because we would then be dependent on others in order to obtain fuel for our power plants. It's like having crude oil in your country but not having the right to build a refinery or produce gasoline. You have crude oil, but you must buy a gasoline from someone else. And that country will sell it to you if it wants to at any price it chooses. And if it doesn't want to sell it to you, it won't. It will come up with an excuse and refuse to sell it. It will say, do this or that, otherwise I won't give you any gasoline. This is their goal. If we have 100 nuclear power plants but no uranium enrichment capability, it will be of no use to us, because a nuclear power plant needs fuel. If we can't produce that fuel domestically, we will be dependent on the US, and they may impose tens of conditions for giving us nuclear fuel. We have already tried this. Regarding 20% enriched fuel in the 2000s, the US president personally asked two presidents of countries who are friends with us to act as intermediaries. He told them to ask Iran to give a portion of its 3.5 enriched uranium, and the US would then provide the 20% enriched uranium that Iran needed. We needed 20% enriched uranium. Our officials accepted their proposal, and it was agreed that the exchange would take place. I said the deal must proceed in this way, that they bring the 20% enriched uranium to Bandar Abbas, and we would then test it to ensure its authenticity. Only then we would give the 3.5 enriched uranium to them. When they saw we were careful and insistent about receiving 20% enriched uranium, they broke their promise and didn't deliver it. Of course, during that time, when our officials were engaged in those political talks, our own scientists inside the country were able to produce the 20% enriched uranium themselves.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the old days, people that wanted to visit the city of Shiraz would go through the Quran gate. But nowadays, with the volume of cars, only people pass. Join me as I visit the city of Shiraz.
The Quran gate is the first thing you'll notice as you enter the city from the north, as two old copies of Islam's holy book was kept here in the past. Just at the entrance of the city also lies the statue of Haju Kermani, a poet and mystic from the 14th century. His poems are mostly about spirituality. His works are believed to have influenced another Iranian poet called Hafiz, which we'll get to later in this program. Haju Kermani traveled to many lands during his time, but that stopped when he came to Shiraz.
The city of Shiraz is known for its poets and poetry. Many renowned Iranian poets lived here. Haju Kermani, when he visited the city of Shiraz, he never left.
This is likely because the rulers of this land valued arts.
The Arg of Karim Khan is a citadel built during the 18th century as the living headquarters of Karim Khanazan himself. Later it was a prison, and now it's a museum, which we can enter.
Karim Khanazan founded the Zand dynasty and declared Shiraz his capital, and thus many buildings were erected in this city during his rule.
The architecture of the citadel combines military and residential architecture, as was the home of Karim Khanazan and also the head of his military headquarters.
But Karim Khan was different from other rulers of the time. When he came to power, he refused to be called king. He accepted the title the Advocate of the People, that is Vakil in Persian. Many structures built during his time carry Vakil in their name. Stained glass goes hand in hand with Iranian architecture. From homes to palaces, most windows were decorated this way. But it wasn't just for beauty.
The interesting thing about tinted glass is it's first soothing for the environment and for the eyes, and also it keeps the insects away, they say. I don't see any insects here, do you?
Next stop is the Vakil Bathhouse, a place where people from all walks of life would chit-chat and also bathe. At the entry, every part of the society had their own section, and many of the people's problems were resolved just here. It was like the city's or the town's informal council. And about the building itself,
bathhouse. And even in this building, which is a bathhouse, there's lots of detail put in the architecture. So this shows you how much Iranians valued every single building, even a bathhouse. Let's go and check out the rest.
Walking through this bath, I saw wall after wall of detail put in the making. and it's quite big for a place to be. But this also shows this place was more like a hangout or a place they would spend hours in, not just a quick shower like we do today. And may I remind you, they didn't shower every day in the old days.
This place was way more than a bathhouse. Like, for example, one person's having a scrub, the other's having a massage, and of course, one of them is bathing. And on the other side, there's one person getting a haircut, a shave, and that guy there got his tooth pulled out.
The Vakil Mosque is another landmark of Shiraz. The 48 columns in its prayer hall, carved in spirals, are one of its outstanding features. Next is Bazar Vakil, a big market still in use today to find everything from Shiraz and beyond. From spices and herbs to sweets and confectionery, and many, many more, this is the place to visit. You can find every kind of souvenir here, many cool things you can buy, and every quarter has its own goods. One unique part in this bazaar is where several hallways meet.
Okay, many of Iran's bazaars are similar in shape, but the difference for the bazaar in Shiraz is this little part here is called the Saray-e Murshid, where you can get your hands on many little things like little antiques, little jewelry, or little souvenirs where you can take home.
Talking about cool things, there was also an antique shop that topped my list. The Vakil Bazaar is one of the longest stretching and most famous bazaars in Iran. It is located in the center of Shiraz and is amongst Iran's national heritage sites. Saadi, another one of the renowned poets of this land. He was born in Shiraz. He spent more than two decades traveling outside of Persia following the Mongol invasion. His works reflect upon the lives of ordinary people suffering displacement, agony, and conflict. His best-known works, Bustan, meaning the orchard, and Golestan, the rose garden, consist of stories illustrating the standard virtues recommended to Muslims, being justice, kindness, modesty, and gratification.
Saadi is one of the most famous Iranian poets of all time. His poetry is seen all over the world, not just in Iran. One of the verses that is seen in the UN building in New York is, "All men and women are to each other the limbs of a single body, each of us drawn from life's shimmering essence, God's perfect pearl. And when this life we share wounds one of us, all share the hurt as if it were our own. You who will not feel another's pain, you forfeit the right to be called human." This was just one.
And talking about flowers and gardens, the city of Shiraz is also famous for its Persian gardens. And in spring, the scent of flowers fills the sky in this city. The whole city is like a big flower shop. And last but not least is Persian poet Hafez. He was a spiritual poet and mystic known by his pen name Hafez. It means a person that knows the Quran by heart. It is believed that he also knew the works of Saadi, Rumi, and several other poets by heart too. His mausoleum located in a garden is where people gather to recite his poems, relax, and enjoy the environment. It's a popular hangout for artists in Shiraz.
Hafez, one of the most prominent Iranian poets of all time. While he passed away several centuries ago, still you can find his poems in the homes of Iranians today. So this shows you how important he was in Persian literature. Some regard him as the pinnacle of Persian literature. and a goodbye from Shiraz. I'm Pedram Khaledari for the Iran program.
The faith in our hearts will always